You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 271. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White, recording for you out of my basement here in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on the program tonight, the new classic crew. If that sounds like a thing, is that a thing?
I think that's Coke 2 was the new classic. I think we're Coke 2.
Oh God, Mr. John Gentile in Philadelphia and Mr. Ricky Frankel in LA. Hello.
Yo.
You got the right one, baby. I think that's Pepsi.
It might have been. Whenever I think about Coke, not the drug, the beverage, I can't help but think about there was a Diet Coke commercial that was.
Yes, wait, Adam, let me guess. It's the one where the ladies go out the window to look at the construction worker. Am I right?
No. There was a Diet Coke commercial that was on the VHS cassette tape for the 1989 Tim Burton Batman movie. And I don't know why they included the commercial on the cassette tape, aside from the fact that I'm just guessing that, like, that. You know, back in those innocent days of 1989, you didn't always have like the full brunt of a movie crew put together a commercial for you, because in the commercial they had, I think, like the Batmobile drives by or something like that, and then the guy that they had playing Alfred in those movies, there's a little jingle that comes in where they're like, just for the taste of it, Diet Coke, and then what's it called? Then Alfred goes because he has like a really nice swig of Diet Coke. I always think about that when I think about Coke.
I forgot about the jingle. What I always think about when we're talking about classic soda commercials is one with Ray Charles and the moon guy that has the moon head. And like Ray Charles is playing the piano and the moon guy is drinking Diet Coke. And like there's a bunch of good looking women around them. And like that's the whole commercial.
I feel like there was a moon guy in the McDonald's pizza commercials.
Maybe it wasn't McDonald's. No, I think it was Pepsi. Maybe both of them had that.
Oh, I feel that like this is all that I have from my youth. I don't really remember my family or things that I did, but I remember some things about commercials.
Adam, do you remember? I learned it from you, Dad. Do you remember that one, the classic?
I don't know if I do.
Well, maybe that was a USA one. Ricky, do you know? I learned it from you, Dad.
What product was it selling?
Oh, wait, product precisely is what it was selling. Product.
Well, yeah, I don't know when did that. When do you think that ran?
I went to Punk News listeners, probably like 85, 86. I went to Punk News listeners to write in to remember if they remember the commercial. I learned it from you, Dad. Podcast.
Ricky was born in like 2000 and what? Two?
Yeah, but
so how would you know?
Well, maybe his dad's with that commercial when his dad was a youth.
You guys are 10 years off, but you know, we can say 2002, sure.
You were born in 2012?
No, 92.
Ricky was born the first year I bought a Metallica cassette.
I'm remembering a Diet Coke commercial from several years before Ricky was born. Okay.
Sorry I couldn't participate
in that
part.
What's it like to live in a world where you've never not known of Puff Daddy?
I have. I just know him more as what's it called? He does the fashion line or whatever.
See, Adam White, you and I remember the pre-Puff Daddy days, do we not?
I do, but they're fading. And you know what? Speaking of Puff Daddy, the other night, I spent a good amount of time with the Vote or Die song from South Park. Going over and over in my head, because we had an election in Canada on Monday, and at one point I thought that it would be really funny if I went onto Twitter or whatever and started sharing around the Vote or Die thing. And then I thought to myself, that's fucking asinine. Why are you doing that? So I didn't do it. But the song was stuck in my head. So there you go. All right. If anyone wants to write us emails and tell us about how pointless the show has become.
you guys are right, one baby.
Yeah, you can do so at podcast.punknews.org. Before we get into the week's news, which has some pretty interesting stories, if you ask me, let's talk a little bit about records, because this is the crew that is on the show that usually talks about records. So, you know, what are you guys feeling? What are you acquiring? What are you finding out there that's interesting? Ricky, you always got a whole ton. What's up?
Well, I don't have a ton this week because, you know, what I do when we do this is I'll have a list from like the last 4 months from the last time we did it and just include it. But so Nightbirds album came out, got that from Fat Wreck, got the alternative with the alternative album art, and it was like 180 gram vinyl, only 500 hand numbered, came out. I got number 373. Also, my
I got number 372, Ricky. How do you like that?
Also, I ordered a lot, you know, it felt like a while ago, but, and I think it was, but, I got my Fat Wreck Going Nowhere Fat, comp on vinyl, and it came on one disc was translucent red. The other one's translucent blue. I've also had friends show me that they got like a translucent gold and a translucent pink one. So I guess they're random colors going out there. And then I got Introspect's Real Politic off Discogs because I've been wanting that for a while. And Leftover Crack. I think some
of
the
new members. Is Introspect the band with the five in it?
Yes. Yes. And I think the new guitarist that replaced Ezra is from Introspect also. So I kind of wanted to see what that was all about. I only heard their cover of Nazi White Trash on it, but I want to get more into it. And then. This is something that we unfortunately did. I don't think we talked about last time we did this, but Asbestos Records is an indie label, and they actually got the rights from Sire to repress Against Me's New Wave.
Ah, did you hear Laura Jane's Grace commentary on that?
I did. I did. And I felt kind of, and that kind of sucked. But so my copy came today. What happened was they pressed, Sire originally pressed like 6,000 on translucent yellow, 180 gram vinyl. And those go from like $80 to $200. And I actually found one like 4 years after it came out at Amoeba San Francisco before I really knew what I had. And so looking back, that's probably one of my best finds ever. But so Asbestos Records repressed it on like half yellow, half black vinyl for like 1,000 copies. But if you pre-ordered from their site and spent a little bit extra, some of the money went towards like a anti-transgender like suicide charity. So and if you did that, you got like a shirt, and 200 copies came on translucent red. So I have the translucent red one.
But Ricky, why don't you mention Laura Jane Grace's comment?
And I will
and
now
dwell on the ethics of the issue involved.
I will. Let me
Adam, wait till you hear this.
Let me get to my last three records, and then I'll go into it.
last three.
I only have three. Okay, so I got my Eradicator that I played last time I was on. I got their white 10-inch that I've been waiting for a little bit. Very interested. I mean, that was a great album. I mean, an EP if you guys enjoyed that. I played that last time. And then I went to It's Not Dead Fest, and Fat Wreck had a booth there, and of course I had to go to it. So I got Descendants Cool to Be You on just clear vinyl, and then Propagandhi's Today's Empires, Tomorrow's Ashes on like this gray marble vinyl. So it was cool to be able to get these color albums from Fat without having to pay for shipping. Okay, so apparently on Turned Out a Punk, and I did listen to it, when Laura Jane Grace was on, they talked about how Sire got to keep one record and they got to keep another. And I think they kept White Crosses and Sire kept New Wave, and they never decided to repress it. So apparently Asbestos Records just did it without really kind of telling Against Me about the repressing or sending them a free copy. Even though, I mean, technically, I think legally Against Me has no say in it, but still, like, it probably would have been a classy move to send the members, like, hey, we repressed your record here. And that's pretty much the gist of it, isn't it, John?
Well, what happens was Sire Records owns the sound recordings and I believe the publishing to New Wave. So yeah. Asbestos Records is a small record label, and they obviously wrote Sire Records and say, listen, will you license New Wave to us so we can put it on vinyl? So they said yes. So they hatched out some deal. So they put out all these vinyl editions of New Wave that people snatched up, but the band didn't get a penny from it. And so the ethics is legally – Asbestos Records and Sire Records are on solid ground, but are they respecting the artist by doing that? Could they at least cut the artist a little slice of meat, you know, or maybe charge an extra dollar or two for the record and, you know, just give the artist a check, you know?
Well, I think Laura was just kind of like on the podcast, she just seemed like she was very like just kind of agitated that they didn't even send her a copy.
Yeah, well, I mean, think about when artists put their heart and soul, or even when they just create a creative work, it must be troubling to see people control your creative work that you don't even know. That a lot of that happened with was it Crass Records? Yeah, I think it was Southern Records out in England. After John Loder died, one of the employees for Southern Records somehow came into ownership of the Southern Lord Masters. So a lot of the bands on Southern Records, not Southern Lord, rather Southern Records, found their works being controlled by someone they didn't even know when they originally didn't think things through necessarily, but I don't mean that pejoratively. They didn't maybe think of all possible consequences, and they just thought, oh, John Loder will always release our records, but John Loder passed away. And so a lot of these bands that had handshake deals kind of lost control of their creative rights, which is a bummer. I guess it's just the nature of the beast, you know, but I mean, I think the classy thing to be, you know, maybe print up an extra 50 copies and say, here you go, against me, sell them, keep them, do whatever you want. You know, it doesn't cost me that much, and you can make a few bucks off of it. You know, that is the classic thing to do. Like, not even write them money, you know, print up an extra 50 copies, extra 100. That's only a couple of hundred extra bucks. Mail to the band and say, here you go, you sell them or do whatever you want with them, you know?
Yeah, so I mean, they didn't go too much into it, but apparently, I think to some extent, like Laura kind of knew like that could have happened eventually because they chose one record to keep for themselves from Sire. So,
I don't think they got to pick though. I think Sire just gave them the second record because Sire didn't think it was really worth anything. So they were like, well, you can have it then.
Yeah, so here's the thing that strikes me as kind of weird about this release. So, so you've got the Asbestos copy then, right?
Yeah, I have both.
All right, so is the label on the Asbestos copy like the giant Asbestos Records logo, like on the actual like the sticker on the vinyl itself?
It's on the back. Yeah, I think it's on the B side.
Oh, okay. Just because there's a picture of the album with the black yellow split that's on the Asbestos Records Facebook page, and it like. The way that it really super prominently features the logo of their label, at least in the picture that they're showing. I mean, maybe they just doctored it up for the sake of this picture.
Yeah,
it's kind of weird to me. Like, I mean, it wasn't a release that they put out. Sire, like initially, like they don't. I mean, I guess they could stick their label on it because they're you know doing a reissue or something like that. But to have it like so heavily carry the iconography of this label that had nothing to do with it, when at the same time Sire, who put the record out, was a big deal at the time. Like Sire is a label with some fucking history to it, and like that was partly the reason why they went on there.
Ramones, Talking Heads, yeah, Dead Boys.
It's weird to see this Instagram picture that they put up of the record with like a huge Asbestos Records gas mask in the middle of it, where I'm thinking like, that's, you didn't really have anything to do with this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not going to say go to, I mean, if you want to go to mine, I did take a picture of both copies, I think that's the B side. The A side just says Against Me New Wave.
I guess. Ricky Frankel, what's your Instagram account? So everyone can go look at your pictures of you being sexy.
What if we go there? It's like new shots of like,
it's just also DesertBurst92, like my Twitter account. They also kind of put it on the back too, but they kept everything else. I mean, like their logo on the back, but they also kept, like the insert pretty much the same. But I don't think it's as good of a quality of a copy as the original, just because of the thickness. I'm happy to have it. I think I'm going to just retire my first pressing because I don't want that one to go to shit if I can avoid it.
I love the album art for this record. I hate the font, but I love the album art.
It's a good one, yeah.
No, it's not a good font.
No, I mean a good album art.
new wave?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the panther.
It is just striking. It has been for all this time. John, you got any record stuff you want to talk about before we presumably listen to the show?
As everyone knows, I'm a deep record digger. I go for the rare stuff, the obscure stuff, the weird stuff. Let me tell you, I found something really cool if you're into reggae. I found a 7-inch Peter Tosh EP. It's the only Peter Tosh EP there is, and it's really the only, and it's an extremely rare 7-inch reggae EP, which is really weird. But what's really neat about it, it's the 7-inch record for Legalize It. It was a promo record released to radio stations to let American radio stations know about Peter Tosh. There's about 4 versions of Legalize It, maybe 5. However, what I discovered upon playing this 7-inch record is it's a unique version of Legalize It that's never been released anywhere else, which is super cool. Not on any CD, not on any compilation, not on any digital compilation. It's the same sound recording as the album version of Legalize It, but in a different mix with the organ way up in the front and a couple other sound effects. So that's what's really fun. You find that a lot in reggae and sometimes in country western. Different versions that just slip onto promos and that kind of stuff. So, and what also is neat, on the flip side, there's a track called Till the Well Runs Dry, which is a beautiful, beautiful song. Maybe I'll play it a little bit later on. And I think it's actually a unique version too. I think the fade out is much longer because the album version is like 5 minutes, but this version is like 7 minutes. And I think it's actually what they call a traditional song, and that it's a song so old that nobody knows who wrote it. And it is a beautiful, moving song. And maybe I'll play it later on tonight's podcast. That was a great find and a fun find for me. What else I got is, this is not a rare record, but this is why records themselves are so cool. I got a copy of Funkadelic, so Let's Take It to the Stage. And as you probably know, Funkadelic is one of George Clinton's band. It's his probably hard rock / hard funk band, as opposed to Parliament, which is his funk band, or just George Clinton, which is kind of a mixture of all the three with some dance music in it too. And then there's the Parliaments, which is a 50s soul and doo-wop group. So there's four George Clinton groups. Parliaments, which is a doo-wop group. Parliament, which is a funk group. Funkadelic, which is a hard rock, trippy, proto-heavy metal band. And then there's George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic, which is all of those mixed together with some dance music too. Well, most of the Funkadelic records were drawn by a guy called Pedro Bell, a phenomenal 70s artist. And his art is extremely trippy, extremely psychedelic, extremely weird. And I've had the CDs for a long time, but I just got the record. And that is one of the important – it's been said before, but just the Pedro Bell art is – like his actual art is tiny. There's a whole lot on the records, but because the records are so big, it's so intricate, and there's so much on it, it is – one of the best demonstrations of the virtue of the size of a record. His art looks like, and the records fold out. It looks like an art like that you'd put in a museum. It is like so interesting. It's so, you could look at the record jacket for an hour and a half and still not see everything in there. So just do a favor for yourself. Next time at your record store, look for some Funkadelic records with the hand drawn Pedro art covers, Pedro Bell covers. And it is beautiful, wonderful art, which obviously you don't see in MP3s anymore. CDs are cool, but the art is a lot smaller. It's big, beautiful art, and it just goes to show that the record itself is an art piece, not only in the sound recordings, but in the art and the demonstration together. So it's almost like two pieces of art bound together, which I never really thought about so much, but it's just cool. Last thing I'll go quick is, over the past 2 or 3 years, I've really discovered that a lot of the 80s one-hit wonders bands are actually really, really, really good bands, and there's much more to them than their one hit if you listen to them. The first band I discovered that with was Dexy Midnight Runners, which is a wonderful, amazing band that Come On Eileen is a great song, but their discography is so deep and so varied. The second band, of course, I discovered that with was Bow Wow Wow. After that, Flock of Seagulls. The latest one is Modern English. Of course, we know the Modern English song is I'll Stop the World and Melt With You. Well, I got the 12-inch single, and I love UK 12-inch singles because they've got, like, weird tracks on the flip side. The A side is Melt With You. The B side is these two far-out, heavy-as-hell tracks. They kind of sound like Joy Division. They kind of sound like New Order. They kind of sound like Gary Numan. They're these super dark, super weird, super experimental, super heavy tracks. And so I'm just saying, if you see Modern English in the dollar bin, pick it up because they've got some cool, really, like, pop songs. But they've got some of these experimental, heavy, almost Bauhausian tracks. And it just goes to show not all bands are what the 80s make – I mean what the radio makes them out to be.
Cool. I don't really have all that much that's super interesting. I just knew you guys would, so I kind of prompted you to do this segment. I mean, I picked up a couple things the other day. They're by no means storied or fascinating, but I have now found one of my new favorite places to find records, which is the damaged bin. And it's only because I had a great conversation with the clerk at SRC Vinyl here in the Falls, because I'm going through their damaged bin and I pulled out, like, none of this is rare, but it was super cheap. It was a copy of Less Than Jake's Borders and Boundaries and a copy of The Great Awake, which was the first record that the Flatliners put out for Fat. And I'm sitting here looking at them in the store and they look fine. Like, I don't see anything that is wrong with them at all. So I kind of bring them up and I'm like, these are in the damaged bin and they're like under $10. Like, what's the deal with this? And the issue turns out to be that, I don't know, there's some mild cover creasing that I'm looking at them now and I can't find it. Right. And I'm like, really? Like, you're cutting like half your profit off this record because there's some maybe mild cover creasing that I can't even see. I'm like, my records probably look like this anyways, just by playing them. And the clerk was like, yeah, so do mine. I don't know. But hey, there's collector people that are going to walk in here and like analyze absolutely everything with a little, one of those little jeweler glasses. Right. So we got to discount these. So, hey, I'm now I'm all about that. I'm going to go back there and just hang out and just take things out of their damaged bin.
Adam, if you want, you can even damage records so they get put in the damaged bin.
I can hire a homeless guy to go in there, bend records slightly, put them in the bin, and then don't tell them that. But anyway, so I was there and I picked those up, and I'm happy about that because I for the life of me, cannot notice the damage, or at least I'm sure I would end up damaging them to the same degree just by having them. So that's okay. I also wanted to gripe because unlike Ricky John, unlike you, I'm easing into this record collecting thing. And only because I don't go nuts about it. I've been trying to, feed my family, pay my mortgage, all those boring things that I'm supposed to do before I go out and just like drop tons of money on records. And as I'm getting more into it, the mail order thing is just killing me.
Deadly.
Oh fuck. And this might be a Canadian thing, maybe, but I'm looking at this and it's driving me insane. So I hop onto the Buzz Records Bandcamp page, and everyone's selling their vinyl and everything on Bandcamp now, which is fine. I can do that. So I get on there. I want to buy a copy of the new record from Hussey called Basque. I want to buy a new copy of the record from Dilly Dally called Soar. Each of the records are listed on there as $16 USD. So, okay, fine. But I put them together, put them in my cart. $16 USD translates out to about $42 Canadian once you add the two together. So 16 plus 16, right? And then by exchange. So, okay, fine. Exchange rate, I can't do anything about that. Now, granted, this label's in Toronto, so what the fuck? But hey, I'm not going to worry about that. The world moves in American currency. But the shipping on each of the records is like another $10 on top of that.
Ooh.
$10 American or Canadian?
American.
Oh, basically. Shit. Okay.
So like, well, I think, well.
Adam, do you have media mail in Canada? Just curious.
I don't know, but I'm not really sure. Maybe. I don't know what that is.
I think what he would have to do is you probably have to click on like international shipping instead of media mail. I think media mail only applies to the U.S.
Well, it does, but I'm asking if
here. I'm looking at my shopping cart here. I see subtotal before shipping, $41.95 Canadian.
Ooh.
Okay. Shipping, $19.67 Canadian. Ooh. Ah, right. Total, yeah. $61.62. Right. For two records. Now, I'm looking right now at Dilly Dally's Twitter account. There's a picture of a guy with a big shit-eating grin at their merch table. And if I zoom in and look at the price, it says LP $15. Now, that's $15. That's not, you know, $26. I realize this is a good argument about why I should just like go to stores and buy these things. But some of the stuff like this, I'm not going to find in a store around here. So that means I have to drive like an hour and a half to go to a city where I can find one of these things in the store. So
I have a couple.
I don't even know what I'm complaining about. I'm complaining about market forces that I can't control, which is the exchange rate and the fact that I don't live in a big city. But I'm still going to complain.
I do have two stories. I mean, one, when I pre-ordered the Successes album this year, I actually saw them and it was cheaper. I pre-ordered on Interpunk and it was probably like, I think it was like $5 shipping, but also Interpunk, you know, put a few bucks more on it for their profit. So I actually I saw them and they were selling it for, instead of like paying $17 for it, they were selling it at their merch table for $12. So I canceled my order right away on my iPhone and just said, fuck this, I'll buy it here now.
Well, you should always buy from bands directly or labels directly if you can.
Right. I just had no idea. It was sort of a surprise show. I had no idea they were going to be in town. Now, something interesting was once I ordered, and I don't know how this happened, but it worked. I ordered the Rebel Spells last album, which I'm forgetting what it's called, but what was it called? Anyway, it was Rebel Spells' very last album. That was the only one they put on vinyl, so I ordered it. $5 shipping American from Canada, okay? And that was it. I didn't have to pay anything higher, and I don't know how that happened.
I mean, they took a bath on that. You can't ship anything to Canada record-wise. $9, $10, $11.
Yeah, so I don't know how that happened at all. But, yeah, it's – even here, I mean, it's getting kind of – even media mail starting to get up there, you know, $5, $6 now. Even though that's like the longest one, I mean that takes the longest to get to you.
I love media mail, man. I eat and drink media mail.
So explain to me as a foreigner, what is media mail?
Media mail is a wonderful thing, but flawed, and one of the reasons why the United States Postal Office is doing so poorly. Media mail is hypothetically government subsidized for the purpose of education. What that means is, if you mail a book, if you mail a CD, if you mail a movie, if you mail a cassette tape, it's actually way cheaper than regular mail. It goes slower, but honestly, it doesn't even really go that slower because there are no separate media mail channels. So it goes maybe a couple of days slower. But it's
like, contraire, I have a story, but continue.
It's like half price, sometimes even one third price of what normal mail would be. The problem is the post office actually loses money on it because they can't afford to ship stuff for that late. But the idea is a further education. But I would say less than 1% of media is being sent out for educational purposes. Similarly, a lot of people abuse media mail and like will ship like, you know, 200 pounds of clothes and say it's books, you know. And so recently, media mail has started opening up boxes and checking it, and people get caught all the time, as they should. That's not what it's for. So,
one time, I bought a 7-inch, and it went through media mail, and it came from like, I think like New Jersey. It made it all the way to California. In Southern California, like the Santa Clara post office or the sorting facility or whatever, I look at the tracking number the next day. It's fucking back in Massachusetts.
Well, that's a mistake. That's not like, you know.
I know. It was just like but that's not the first time that's really happened either. So media mail, you to some extent you do take your chance with.
Let me tell you about the Santa Clara post office. Let me tell you, we're going off track here. So one time I sold a bunch of comic books on eBay, and you think record guys are bad? Comic book guys are way, way, way worse. So I package up these comic books nice and neat. I go down to the Santa Clara post office, and this is how I learned this. I'm like, I want to mail this media mail. He's like, can I open it up? And I didn't know that they could do that, so I said, okay. So the guy cuts open my box, but see, I tape it so good, he's tearing at my box, he's ripping at it, he's using his teeth. He mutilated my box and then tears it open, right? He ruins my box, and short of some comic books inside. And he's like, I guess it's good to mail. And then, you know, my label's destroyed. And so, but see, and I would have just taken it back home and said, listen, I'm going to repackage it. But I was actually flying out in like 2 hours. And so I'm like, all right, let's just package it back up. So he tapes it back up. It's a horrible job. Mails it out to this comic book guy. I get negative feedback, all because of the Santa Clara post office. Welcome to the Punk News podcast, where we talk about comic books and post offices.
All right. Let's have a little break here from us talking about nothing. We're talking about vinyl right now. I'm going to play you a new single from the Toronto band Metz. This is the song called Eraser. It's going to be on a new 7-inch that's coming out on 31G and Sub Pop on January 22nd. Speaking of vinyl, there's going to be physical copies of this with a run of 1,000 on green vinyl. And that's all that I know right now. So anyways, this is the first material Metz has put out since the Metz 2 record that came out. This was all recorded with Graham Walsh of the band Holy Fuck at Toronto's Union Sound Company. And here you go. So this is the song Eraser by Metz. We're back. Let's actually talk about news, because that's the name of the show. We're going to talk about a couple bands that I did not even know existed before this story popped out. And it seems like they are everywhere, at least as far as my various Twitter and Facebook feeds have gone this past week. So there's been a bunch of controversy surrounding a shoegaze band called Were, with two R's. So it started out with the band posting some comments on Twitter about a band from Olympia, Washington called Gloss, G.L.O.S.S. The Were band posted a tirade of, how do I describe this? Misogynistic, transphobic kinds of comments. Now, Gloss is a trans punk band, for a trans hardcore band, I guess. So these things were obviously meant to be incredibly insulting to this band, to the people that were listening to them, the people that like them, to the trans community in general. people on when the band or when someone on Twitter had accused Were of being misogynistic, the band replied with something like, what did they say here? They said, misogyny is hating women. Gloss is just a bunch of boys running around in panties making shitty music. And then the band posted a picture of Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs with the statement, this is gloss. So following that, the band was retreating people's reactions to Were's statement. Many people were calling out for their label, which was Run for Cover Records, who had released Were Records in 2014 to disassociate themselves from Were. Run for Cover eventually responded themselves on Twitter saying, we as individuals and as a label are accepting of all people and require the same from the bands and people we work with. We will not be working with Were from this point on and do not support their behavior in any way. We'll post a full statement tomorrow. Gloss is awesome and crucially important, and we need more bands like them. There has been lots of back and forth about this. Lots of people that had worked with Were in various label capacities disassociating themselves with them. Finally, on October 20th, Were went and posted a statement where they claim that their Twitter account was not their own and it was actually run by a friend of the band's who they all thought was funny up until this point, and they had now wrested control of the account back from the friend. I don't know if anyone necessarily believes that based on the reaction from Twitter and everyone else, but that's the story. So there's a whole bunch of angles to this. This was the first time I had listened to Gloss or Were, and I think one is kind of cool, and I think the other one kind of sounds like My Bloody Valentine. John, have you checked this stuff out?
Yes, actually, when Gloss was in Philadelphia not too long ago, it was a huge deal. I believe the show sold out. And when Gloss was in San Jose when I was there, it was actually the same day that I went and saw Victims and The Crowd. Unrelated. I'm sad. I mean, well, you know, it's disappointing that this happened. But for my own personal sake, I'm kind of glad that it happened because now I can further clarify my stance on things in general. The general default John Gentile stance is, how dare you castigate a band for being offensive? How dare you castigating a band for being edgy? How dare you castigating a band for being, you know, weird or unusual or even nasty? This is art. If you don't like art, then you need to toughen up because you don't understand the purpose of art because not all art has to be nice. So I think the default stance is John always supports the artists when they say something mean. I do not support the band on this, and here's why. I think art can be mean. I think art can be nasty. I think art can be offensive. And this is offensive, but this just seemed to be mean to me. There doesn't seem to be any art here. There doesn't seem to be any strategy or any commentary here. It's just guys being nasty, you know? And so I think it was a bullshit thing for them to do. I think it was lame for them to do. There doesn't seem to be really any purposeful art in here unless their purpose is just to provoke a reaction, which some bands do very well, you know, which Black Rain and the Metro Squad did very well, which the Germs did very well, which the Dwarves do well, which the Meatmen do well. But if that's what they're trying to do, they did it extremely poorly without any tact, without any finesse. It's just nastiness for the sake of nastiness. What I was going to say is I suspect what the band – and this is just me guessing. I suspect what the band really wanted to say was they don't think Gloss is a good band, and the only reason why everyone's saying Gloss is a good band is because they have trans members. And if you subtracted that element, then the band themselves is just a bland band. I'm not going to make a comment on that one way or another, but if that was the comment they intended to make, then they did it poorly rightfully so, they're being, you know, punished. Well, I don't know if punished is the right word, but they're being – the general society says, you know, we think you're being dicks. Legally, I certainly think the band can say what they want to say, and if someone tried to censor them, I would support them 100% and say they certainly can say these dumb things. That's their constitutional right. But I also support society for saying you guys are being assholes because they are. Conversely, if they weren't saying they think the band is bad and the only reason the band is getting noticed because there's trans members – if they really are attacking the band because there's trans people in the band, then they're just dicks. But you don't need to, like, call people out for no reason whatsoever. You know what I mean? Well, yeah, I'm just saying it's lame and it's petty and there's no finesse here. And so
– yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, I mean, I think that's relatively clear. Have I been clear, Adam White?
I think you've been clear, John. Ricky, any thoughts on this one?
I mean, I also had not heard of the band Either band until now. I checked out Gloss on YouTube, and they look like they put on a pretty awesome show. When it comes to Were, I'm not a shoegaze fan. I just get bored with that kind of music. But what's kind of interesting to me, one, I why would you give a friend your official Twitter account to be in charge of? And also, this seemed like it was just kind of unprovoked.
Yeah, it did.
I just don't see how there doesn't really seem to be like a main like starting point with this controversy, if you want to call it that. I mean, listen, Gloss seems to be an awesome band. They should just keep going. I mean, if you're gonna, unfortunately, you know, transgender people are gonna have haters, whether people think they're being funny or not, or if they're being just malicious. So just got to keep going. It looks like those shows are a lot of fun. It looks like, and if they sell out, they obviously have a lot of fans. It was probably a good call on the PR side for the label to drop Were also.
No coming back from that one.
I'm obviously, I think everything kind of worked out for the best in terms of this situation.
Well, not for Were. Yeah. They look
I guess not. It's just like, but also like, a friend of ours tweeted that I'm thinking about calling bullshit on that too. Like, I don't know if I really, believe that.
A friend of Punk News retweeted it.
No. I'm talking like they gave their friend their Twitter account. Thought was funny. Yeah. I'm like really that's it. And then like, we haven't heard from that person either. So, this is like a controversy that really, I think it's over. I don't think it needs to be dragged out. It was still shitty though.
Do you guys think it's the end of War of the Band? Is there any coming back from this? That was really high pitched, Ricky.
Yeah, I know. I don't think so.
You think it's over for the band?
I mean, the thing is, like, I wouldn't listen to them anyway. Like, I don't like shoegaze. I don't know how people like are like super into shoegaze like that. So, they'll probably always kind of have like that overtone of like, oh yeah, this was that band that did that thing to Gloss. But I think they'll have to really like, it might take a long time for them to get completely over this.
Apparently, from just what I've gleaned from the commentary on this is that Were has a history of like, trying to be provocative on Twitter or on social media or whatever. Uh-huh. So like, I guess that's what this came from, is like someone at one point was like, this will get a rise out of people. But like, you know, good job, dummies.
It just wasn't clever. It was just kind of dumb.
Yeah, it wasn't clever.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, like, I don't want to cast too much shade on shoegaze. I mean, I like some shoegaze bands and everything, but yeah, way to go. So let's play some Gloss, just in case no one has heard this band before. They had a demo that came out in January of this year that everybody seems to like who has heard it. The thing came out on cassette via the New Normal label. There's a 7-inch version coming out at some point from Total Negativity and Nervous Nelly in the US and Sabotage in Europe. So we're going to play a song from this demo from Gloss. It is called Lined Lips and Spiked Bats. So this is Gloss.
They want to be to become one of them. Sugar and breath, I'm looking.
And we're back. Let's talk about another controversial band, but this band's controversial for a different reason. A favorite of mine, a favorite of Ricky Frankel. I'm not sure where Adam White stands in this band. Leftover Crack.
Yes.
They released a new song from their upcoming third album. The new album is going to be called Constructs of the State. It's due out November 27. The new song is called System Fucked. Tricky Ricky, did you dig this track? Oh, and also, of course, the song has Jesse Michaels of Classics of Love and Operation Ivy on it. Tricky Ricky, did you dig this track? Are you excited for the new album? Will it be... Do you think this is the end of Leftover Crack, or do you think that's just another step in their long and storied career?
I don't think this is the end, no. I think they're just going to keep going, unless Sturgeon decides to do, you know, to reinvigorate Star Fucking Hipsters. But I don't know why he would. I think he should stick with this. This song fucking rocked. Jesse Michaels killed it. This is the only album to me that could possibly beat the Nightbirds album, in my opinion, until I hear the whole thing. So I don't want to make any rash decision now, but goddamn, I really like this. I also like the song that they put on the fat comp, during the summer. I'm very excited for this. I love, as soon as I saw the album art, I'm like, oh fuck, this is real. This is really happening. I mean, I've been a fan for like 6-7 years. So I haven't been a fan of theirs when a new one's come out. So I'm very excited for this. I thought it was just a side note. What is it not? I thought it was kind of interesting that the song was debuted on Vice or Noisy. I wasn't sure if Leftover Crack would go that route once they started making new stuff, but I more power to them, I guess. Also, I mean, I know they're going to be going out on tour with War on Women and Anti-Flag. I'm going to try and go to both Southern California shows. Yeah, I'm stoked on this whole thing. Really, really excited.
Adam White, what did you think of the Leftover Crack Jesse Michaels team up?
This is cool. I haven't listened to Leftover Crack in a while. I mean, like, I was like an embarrassingly long time, like, mediocre generica long. This I like. I like hearing more Jesse Michaels whenever I can.
Yeah.
So hey, the two of them together make me quite happy. I'm really curious to see what the rest of this thing sounds like, only because I feel that like the version of Leftover Crack I have in my head might not be quite what the band is doing anymore. Are they still as like completely all over the place as that record, or are they doing something that's more consistent, or like what is the Leftover Crack of today? That's what I want to know. You guys don't have to tell me. I'm going to find this out by listening to the record, but my interest is piqued.
Yeah, I'm excited for this record. I actually just saw them this past weekend. They sounded really tight. They sounded really hardcore. If anything from the live songs, if the live songs are indicative, the new songs are going to be more hardcore and less ska bass in the past, and almost more crusty, I guess. So I'm excited for this release. I love to hear Jesse Michaels. Jesse Michaels says he's not really into doing music right now, which is a shame because everything that guy touches turns to gold. I mean, Jesse Michaels is the master. And but you know, I guess with a talent like Jesse Michaels, that's how, you know, genius. And I think he's a genius. Genius comes, you know, rarely, but when it comes, it's there, you know. I mean, just everything that guy touches is just amazing. You know, Common Rider, Operation Ivy, Classics of Love, this track, the Bruce Lee Band track, he's the champ. So
also, I mean, I think what will be really interesting to see, based on the Fat Wreck's website, they have the track listing for Constructs of the State. And there are two cover songs on there, which I thought was kind of interesting. One is a Blackbird Rom song called, Last Legs, which, if you haven't heard that record, Destroying, it's one of the best folk punk records I've ever heard. But listen to that track. I think we had a story about it on Punk News a few months back. Also, they covered a Introspect song called The War at Home, which will be interesting to hear because it's kind of like this electro highly electro, like crust punk song, which is also really cool. It should be interesting to hear how they take that on. But yeah, when I saw them earlier this year, they also did a few new songs. I think they did Don't Shoot and The Lie of Luck, and both sounded really good. So I can't wait to hear what the studio versions sound like.
All right. Well, cool. So I guess we should move on and talk a little bit about a weird story, in that it does not sound particularly notable. It's more about what it doesn't say. Husker Du has a website. Everyone calm down.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Guys, I got to get off the podcast. I got to go online. Look at Husker Du's website. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
So the band has a website. This is news. This would not be news for most bands because all bands have websites pretty much, but it is the first time in more than 20 years when the collective members of Husker Du have done something together, amicably, I guess. So, Greg Norton, bassist for the seminal Minneapolis-based band, he shared what little news there was with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. He said that they have worked out a licensing agreement for their music, that there should be an official Facebook page coming soon, guys.
Hey? Whoa!
Oh my official. God! Oh my God! Oh
whoa!
My God.
And that there is, and this is really the important part of the story, that there is ongoing communication between the three of us. So, take that for what you will. I mean, hey, I'm all for anything. You know, I'm all for any Husker Du news. I'm down. I love that band. But this is basically news that there is a place you can go buy t-shirts now. So,
okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, don't get too excited. I know that some people were like, you can buy t-shirts. It's a reunion. And I don't know if that's necessarily the case. But, you know, if you want the cover to Land Speed Record on a shirt, you at least have somewhere to go buy it that's not from a bootlegger. So there's that. You know, weird story, but it was reported all over the place. So
I know they're a seminal band, but I never, for some reason, found the time to get into them. Where's a good place to start? You know?
So if you're me, mm-hmm. And this might not be the place to start, but the first Husker Du record that I ever heard was New Day Rising. And
okay.
The first time I heard it was I was in like early years of university or something like that. And it just took over my life. There's for all of the bands that they kind of get lumped into and get compared with, like, because people are always talking about Husker Du in the same. You know, Breath is talking about the Replacements and things like that. But man, like, to me, New Day Rising, this band in general, just sounds like no other band. It is just wall of sound in a way that I don't think you can really hear from a lot of other stuff. That it's super evocative to me. It's super interesting. It's super dense. I don't know. Like, and I mean, especially on like New Day Rising, it can get super weird. So anyways, yeah, that is the one that I was introduced to. So that one's always going to be my favorite. But you know, Zen Arcade, you can't go wrong with, a lot of people think that they got a little bit too poppy on, Candy Apple Gray and some of their later stuff, but I don't really know if you listen to it now, and to me, it doesn't sound that much like it, but,
okay.
You know,
Adam, do you know why these guys hate each other so much? Do you know why?
I don't know the history of why they hate each other so much. There's one of those things I'm not schooled in.
Yeah, they like really hate each other. Like some bands like just like hate each other, but this band really hates each other. Maybe not so much anymore, but. Whew.
So, yeah. So, hey, if they can agree to have a website, then maybe that's.
Listen, if they can get together for their financial benefit.
Yeah. So then maybe that's all that we can hope for any of us.
Well, I mean, honestly, I do approve of a band taking back its artistic rights and profiting off it, as opposed to a bootlegger profiting off of that, you know. So
yeah, so you know what, I'm gonna rearrange our show schedule just a little bit here. Before Ricky, we get to your song, let's just do one more. One other thing that popped up in the world of media and making money this week is that Victory Records, a bunch of their music has disappeared from the Spotify online service. Victory is arguing that Spotify is not properly paying publishing royalties that are due to Victory Records artists. And the label is basically, or the label, the streaming service has basically pulled everything until this dispute is solved. The statement from Victory says, we have asked that our catalog not be pulled, that we could amicably work with Spotify, and they haphazardly removed our content regardless. 53 million streams, as per Spotify's statements, were identified with no publishing royalties being paid by Spotify. The issue of non-payment for songwriters and composers is a widespread problem and not exclusive to Victory Records artists. So, there you go. This is an interesting story for a couple reasons. I think I just heard one of you laughing, and the reason is probably
can we just talk about Husker Du reuniting to produce t-shirts again?
The reason why I'm laughing, I'll let you finish it in a minute, but like, what is 53 streams like $5?
No, 53 million.
53 million streams, is that still like $5 from Spotify or something?
It's probably like 70, it's like $6.25.
Yeah. I mean, but continue, Adam.
Oh, I thought you were going to laugh about like all of the infamous disputes that Victory seems to have with bands contracts and stuff like that. But
that too. I mean, like, this is just like an issue. Like, I'm so glad I'm not involved in. Because I would not want to.
Are you saying you're glad that you never signed to Victory Records? Is that what you're saying?
I don't want to be involved with Victory. I don't want to be involved with Spotify. This looks like it just kind of fucked sideways. So I do not care.
Breaking news, folks. Ricky Frankel declares he is glad he never signed the Victory Records. Just saying. Breaking news.
This is, yeah. So, I mean, to me, the interesting part of the story isn't the, I don't know, the weird Victory Records schadenfreude that we're trying to throw at this. I think it's more that, like, I'm curious if this is actually indicative of a bigger problem that's happening. I mean, like, there's one thing about getting paid, you know, fractions of pennies per stream. There's another thing about just not being paid because the reporting system doesn't work or something like that. So if that's the actual story here, that's interesting to me. Like, I don't want to bury the lead too much and just talk about like, oh, Victory's fighting with someone. I'm more curious about like, is Spotify not paying people? Not like at all, like not even fractions of pennies, but at all, because that's a problem.
I agree with that 100%. B, I think Spotify is bullshit. C, I think it's important that people understand that Spotify is entirely private. The only way songs legally can get on Spotify is if they are licensed to Spotify through a chain of licensees. And normally what this is a band will strike a licensing deal with I forget what they call them. I think content, so they call them something. And these guys put songs up on iTunes. They put songs up on Spotify. And also sometimes it's like ASCAP. They track the number of plays on radio and that kind of stuff. So the only way music gets up there, hypothetically, is because it's been licensed to get there. The weird thing is there's a ton of music up on Spotify that nobody knows how it got there. Spotify doesn't know how it got there, and the band doesn't know how it got there. So there's a severe disconnect there, and just because – and what's interesting is legally Spotify – copyright infringement is strict liability, meaning even if you don't intend to do it, you're still liable. Like, for example, let's say someone gives me a song – and they say, John, this song is public domain. And then I put that song on my CD. I'm still liable, even though I thought it was public domain. So Spotify is entirely liable for severe copyright infringement. But because they're so gigantic, like, they're almost like shucking liability. They're saying, well, we don't know what's going on. And this is a problem that you see with a lot of these gigantic corporations. My day job as an attorney is I sue banks that are screwing over people's mortgages. Either they're not crediting them for their mortgage payments, or they're selling their house when the mortgage is current, stuff like that. And often the bank's defense is, well, we don't know what's going on because we're so big. And I become incredulous because I'm like, it's your job to know what's going on. That's why you get money for what you're doing. You know what I mean? So it's the same for Spotify. They're like, well, we don't know what's going on. We're trying to figure it out. It's like, no, you're not trying to figure it out. You're committing severe copyright infringement, and you're liable for millions of dollars. But you're just shucking your shoulders and saying, well, I don't know. And somehow that, like, society and even the courts are saying, well, that's just how it is. I mean, I really wish someone would take Spotify and hammer them. And I guess, I mean, there are grounds for a large class action here. And well, maybe I should get on ground floor in this and really get my piece of the pie and rip off artists like everybody else, you know.
So
my point is this: is Spotify is so gigantic, they don't know how they got this information, and that's severe copyright infringement, and they're just kind of putting up their shoulders and saying, not our problem. So, and it is their problem.
At what point does that just become like just pure negligence, though, or does it ever?
Well, negligence is. Strict liability is less than negligence. Negligence is where you didn't act as a reasonable person would act. All right, well, do you guys want a two-minute legal lecture, Adam White, or you don't?
I'm feeling limber.
Okay, so there's five forms of intent. There's intent. That's where you mean to do something. That is, if I mean – and it's usually described in criminal law, but you can do it in civil law too. If I intend to kill somebody, it means I want to kill – Bill, and I aim my gun at him and I shoot him. Then there's knowledge. That's where you know something will happen, but you don't necessarily intend for it to happen. For example, let's say Bill is on the bus with six other people and I put a bomb on the bus. I intend to kill Bill. I don't intend to kill the other people on the bus, but I know it will when I detonate the bomb. Therefore, I have knowledge that I'm going to kill those people. For criminal and most civil purposes, intent and knowledge are identical when it comes to level of blame. Then there's reckless. Reckless is where you were purposefully aware of the risk of the situation and you choose to act even though you know those risks bore a substantial chance of harming someone. For example, if I'm in the park and I know the park has people in it, but I decide to go duck hunting, I don't intend to kill anybody, and I don't even know that I will shoot somebody, but because I'm shooting at ducks and I know there's people in the park, I'm being reckless because the chances are I know the risks, and there's a substantial chance that I will hurt someone by duck hunting. Do you guys understand so far?
Yeah.
Adam,
fuck ducks, man.
Then, so there's a split there, because those three levels that I discussed are subjective, meaning that we look at the actual intent and knowledge and understanding of the person. Under that is what's called negligence. Negligence is objective. We, in a negligence case, we say, did so-and-so act as a reasonable person would act? For example, if I'm walking down the street and I'm swinging my arms wildly because I think it's a music and I hit somebody and hurt them, then I'm being negligent. You know, well, actually, that's probably reckless, to tell you the truth. Here's a good example. If you own a store and you don't check the floors and someone slips on water, that's negligent because a reasonable person would check their floor for spills. That's negligence. We don't even worry about what the actual person knew or thought. We say, would a hypothetical reasonable person act this way, and did you act in that way? Then below that is strict liability, and that's copyright infringement. Strict liability means it doesn't matter if you knew or if you didn't know. It didn't matter if a reasonable person would act this way or they wouldn't act this way. If you did X, you were liable for X. It doesn't matter. An example for strict liability would be if someone gives me a song and says, John, this is my song, I'll license it to you, and then I sell the song, I make CDs and I sell them, and it turns out the song was owned by somebody else, I'm liable even though I thought I had the rights to the song. That's strict liability. Now, I can sue the other guy, but I am still also liable. The other example is sex with underage minors. Most states, that's strict liability. If a girl says, I'm 18, but it turns out she's 16 and you have sex with her, then you're liable even though she told you she's 18. Strict liability.
Okay.
Cool.
Got it.
I'm educated now.
Yeah. No, at least I know
the difference. Where do I go? Do I go to the Bar Association now? Like, I get some sort of certificate, right?
You should start giving speeches at the Bar Association.
Is that how I get a certificate? Like, I'm pretty close to passing at this juncture, right?
So anyway, the purpose is But Ricky is right. And not only is Spotify strictly liable, they have knowledge that they're liable and they're not really doing anything about it, you know. As for Victory, Tony Brummel's an interesting guy because basically a lot of bands – we certainly don't know, but a lot of bands have sold a lot of records and not seen a dime from Victory. So it's interesting that such a guy might be a force for greater good in the future. And that's just how things play out sometimes.
Now, you know? Apparently, we're not saying that.
We're not saying what?
We're not trying to get sued by Victory Records. By
I'm saying okay. I said a lot of bands have said they haven't seen a penny. I said I don't know, but a lot of bands have said that.
Now, see, I like that Tony Victory is a part of my world. only because he has – no, I'm serious about this. For the longest time, like ever since the early days of Punk News – Tony Victory has been this weird wild card character that always shows up when we start talking about you know, bands that are starting to become big, and then it's like, oh my God, they signed a Victory, and then you see these crazy things about Tony Victory in the news, and you see these he's like a recluse. You never see pictures of him, and then when you do, they all seem kind of crazy, and then it's just like, I love having Tony Victory in my world. He's so interesting. He's like a comic book supervillain. if it turns out that bands have poor dealings with them, that's too bad, I guess, for those bands. But I'm okay with those bands suffering at the expense of my entertainment.
Well, and also it's like, you know, you're aware of the risks at this point. After that, it's on you. You know what I mean?
If Victory went away, and it seemed like for a little while they did, because there wasn't a lot of news on them that was coming through, at least through our channel. But I would be sad because Victory is interesting. I think that they are legitimately an interesting thing that exists.
You know what Tony Brummel represents to me? The main guy in There Will Be Blood.
That's what you think?
That's what I think.
That's what you think? Ricky?
Yeah.
What's up? Play us a song, and then after your song... Maybe tell us about It's Not Dead Fest.
Or you can tell us about Husker Du selling t-shirts.
Let's just do a whole podcast about Husker Du selling t-shirts. Okay, so the song I'm going to play is called Object Permanence by a band called Braver. This and it's off their new album called Torpor. And you can find it at bravermpls.bandcamp.com. They're on Facebook. They're on Twitter, too. This album came up for review that I'll send in probably next week or so. And I'm like, I know this band. I've heard them before. And I looked through my collection of 7-inch records, and I realized that this band was actually pretty good and put out a split with Direct Hit back, I think like 3 or 4 years ago now, and they were really good. The new album is it's a 9-track album called that you can literally name your price for, or you can get it for free. It's a solid album. I gotta listen to it more to really get a good opinion on it. But the song I'm gonna play is the 9th and final track on it, called Object Permanence, and here it is.
From my best friend that all good things must end, so I'd eat, lose sleep, blaming everything on me and you. Oh, what was the use? Just to put it down to the shittier view. Accused beliefs, burns projections at the seams. Any other place, any other time, any other town, any other space, anywhere and down. Swim through debris, drown. We'll be right back.
other time, any other town, any other space, anywhere and down. Swim through debris, drown, rinse, repeat.
All right, we're back. Ricky, tell us a little bit about It's Not Dead Fest.
Okay. It's Not Dead Fest. I mean, it was kind of hard not to hear about it this past few months. I a few people that I talked to initially thought it was fake, and it was this giant festival out in San Bernardino, which is I think like 70 miles east of me. And our new news editor Stevie Allen, her husband and I, we all and Denise from Punk World Views, we kind of went as like a group kind of to do press and take, and they took photos. It was basically like the good. Oh, well, first of all, Kevin Lyman put it on. It was his thing. And hang on a second. It was basically like the best lineups of early Warp Tour on steroids. It was at this giant outdoor amphitheater, and a bunch of really cool old bands, new bands played too, and a ton of booths. Like I talked about, there's the Fat Wreck one that I got those records at. There's a Side One Dummy one. There's a bunch of, you know, there were bars. There was food trucks, and I think a total of like 20,000 people went to it. But the headliners were incredible. I mean, you know, Bad Religion, NOFX, Vandals, Bouncing Souls, Strung Out, Real Big Fish, Less Than Jake, Lagwagon, H2O, Goldfinger, which was really cool to see. I wanted to see Goldfinger. Fishbone, Anti-Flag, 7 Seconds, Pennywise. And then the main reason I went was to see the Descendants, and they kicked ass. And but the main headliners were Bad Religion, NOFX, and Descendants and Pennywise. And what they would do is for those four, they every few hours they would during the day they would spin a wheel on the main stage to see who would like play first, second, third, fourth later that night. And Descendants went on first and they killed it. Bad Religion did awesome. NOFX were actually really good. They did a lot of older stuff. Pennywise also did well. I think they went on last. NOFX did like The Bruise, which I hadn't heard them play before. And then there are a bunch of also like really cool small bands, like Swingin' Utters, Riverboat Gamblers, Sham 69 played. That was cool. TSOL, Left Alone, The Briggs, Interrupters. And actually, even though Rancid was not here for this, who was it? Tim Armstrong got on stage with them to do a song. Who else? It was so old school. Like they actually brought in like a half pipe too, in between some of two of the the stages. Dwayne Peters, Gunfight, CJ Ramone, like I said, Devil's Brigade, the Dickies. It was really cool. I mean, the only problem I had with it was it was just incredibly dusty out there and really fucking hot. But other than that, I mean, overall, it was done well. I hope this becomes like a thing every year, because, you know, the festivals out here, I think, are total shit now. And there's not any good, like, real punk festivals like Fest. And my heart hurts every time I miss Fest in California, because I'm out here in California. So I'm hoping this becomes like a yearly thing. I also did two interviews that are coming up. I have to finish one, but I believe by the time this podcast comes out, the CJ Ramone one will have been up, which I think comes out tomorrow, which indeed is Thursday.
So it'll be up by now. Check out Ricky CJ Ramone. And actually, Ricky CJ Ramone interview is really, really, really good. So you should you should definitely check that out.
Yeah, we kind of talked about everything. I tried to do like from like when he was in the military all the way up until what he's doing now. It's a really cool read. We talk about him being on the Howard Stern show and with the Ramones, and like how and being in the Marines. And he was a really nice guy. I think he was just a little tired, just because I talked to him after he had done his set. And it was, it had to have been 105, 110 maybe out there. But yeah, this was cool. And I hope that we can, Punk News can be involved in it. That's up to everyone else though. But yeah, if you didn't go this year, go. I felt kind of bad if anyone listened to the Anxious and Angry podcast around this when this happened. Off with Their Heads were in Hollywood the same day, and he was talking about how he called it quote unquote old person fest or whatever. So, but that was just kind of funny. Yeah, go to this. Do you guys have any thoughts on this fest or anything like that?
That lineup sounds like totally up my alley. I wish I could get to something that has that sort of lineup, because that's clearly a thing that is put together to appeal to, like, you know, people of our ilk, where maybe the Warped Tour itself has passed us by as far as band lineups, you know? So
yeah, no metalcore to be seen there. So
yeah, that sounds amazing, Ricky.
It was very cool.
Mr. John, do we have anything else we're doing on tonight's show?
I'll just rattle this off super quick. Burger Records, one of my favorite record labels, they're re-releasing a album by a band called Nervous Gender. John, who's Nervous Gender? Nervous Gender was John, who's the Screamers? Screamers are one of the greatest punk rock bands of all time. Maybe the greatest punk rock band to never release an album or even a single. The Screamers were a synth punk band with Paul Rosler, Tomata Duplenty, a couple of other people. Basically, some of the most weird, hard, unique punk rock there is. Well, after they broke up, Paul Rosler and Don Balls of the Germs formed a band called Nervous Gender with Frank. This record is long out of print, never been on CD. It's like $300 on vinyl if you want to get it. You can get it on cassette for $6. This is not your first step for punk rock. This is not your first step for even synth punk. Check out the Screamers first. But this, I'm glad that one of the benefits, that the fact that music is essentially worthless these days and that records are being put out super cheaply, is that we can get all this archive classic material. So Nervous Gender is not an easy listening band. They can be difficult, but they're extremely unique, extremely weird, and definitely worth your time. That's all I have to say about that.
So the song in particular that we posted,
Monster.
You've listened to it, I take it. Is it referencing back to Cher's Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves?
It could be.
I think it is.
This is how dumb I am, Adam. Today I just learned that the Sex Pistols song New York is about the New York Dolls, even though they include multiple New York Dolls titles in the song itself. That's how dumb I am.
So, someone on this, one of our listeners that's a Cher expert, or at least listen to the same oldie station as a young boy as me, go listen to this song we posted, and then let me know if that's true. Because, that's all I got to say. All right. I think that's all. Are we done?
You got the right one, baby.
Yeah, I think we are.
So that is a Punk News podcast where we talk about things. If anyone wants to email us, podcast@punknews.org is how you do that. And we'll see you guys next week.